Hello and welcome to the Majlis, the podcast by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, focusing on Central Asia. I am Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. We have been keeping close eye on China's role in Central Asia on the Majlis, and lately there is a spike of interest in this topic, mostly raising red flag about the consequences of partnership with China. Recent examples being Sri Lanka and the small African nation of Djibouti. We will get into details of those examples during the discussion, but briefly, last year most of Sri Lanka's revenue went to China to repay the loan it has taken to build infrastructure projects, some of them said to be barely used. Once the interest for these loans culminated to as high as 7%, Sri Lanka has recently ended up handing over the sovereign right of its biggest and the most strategic seaport to China for 99 years. Both of these nations were trapped as part of China's One Belt, One Road initiative, which brings me to Central Asia, which stands at the center of this mega project and is desperately in need of hard currency. As more investment is underway from China, the question is, as of today, where does the region stand in its financial dealings with China, and what does this mean to the region, and what are the signs about the developments yet to occur? To discuss all these, I'm joined by a panel not like others. Joining us from Bishkek, Talant Sultanov, advisor to Kyrgyzstan's ex-prime minister Isakov. In fact, his prime minister ended up in jail in controversy involving Chinese loan. From India, joining us is Sam Bhotia, who covers Central Asia for the Economist Intelligence Unit. From Philadelphia, Nadege Roland, author of the book called China's Eurasian Century, Political and Strategic Implications of the Belt and Road Initiative. From Prague, we have Bruce Spanier, who is the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owazi. Welcome on board, colleagues.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Very nice to have you. So let's jump straight into Central Asia. Sam, you did a fresh story on this topic involving Central Asia. Tell us what has prompted you to do this story.
I think it's just looking at the levels of debt in Central Asia. I think with Hambantota, the example that you pointed out before,
in Sri Lanka,
and,
yeah,
with Malaysia also withdrawing two projects from China's BRI. I think the BRI initiative, as well as China's lending, has kind of been propelled to the forefront. And I think what we're seeing in Central Asia at the moment, especially for these smaller countries like Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, is that they're quite leveraged in terms of how high the levels of public debt with respect to the GDP are. I think for Kyrgyzstan, I think we're looking at around maybe about 62% of the GDP, whereas for Tajikistan, we're looking at about 40 to 50% of the GDP, public debt as a proportion of the GDP. So these are rudimentary figures, but at the same time, they do, in a way, point to warning signs about whether there may be debt sustainability issues in the future. So the thing is that we're not necessarily saying that just because public debt is high, that these countries will necessarily run into debt problems in the future, but just that this could be an indicator for some trouble to come.
Sam, you said the public debt ranging 60 to 70% portion of the GDP of Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan. So what does it has to do with China?
I think we already know that in 2017, more than half of Tajikistan's debt was accounted for by Chinese loans. And I think for Kyrgyzstan, it should be about maybe around 40 to 50%, slightly lower. So a substantial portion of loans for both Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan do originate in China. And I think China's Export-Import Bank is one of the largest creditors, the single largest creditor to Kyrgyzstan and maybe for Tajikistan as well. So we're seeing a lot of Chinese multilateral agencies being involved in lending in both Tajikistan as well as Kyrgyzstan.
High range of public debt and significant portion of that has to do with China. So what does it say, those two small nations, Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan?
I think it just means that these countries have become really dependent on China when it comes to lending. And we could see a pattern emerging where these countries continue to remain dependent on China for a foreseeable future. Just because of the environment that is created where, let's say, China is lending a substantial amount of money to Tajikistan for some projects, maybe like a thermal power project, and maybe Tajikistan isn't able to pay back the entire amount of the lending for that thermal power project, and maybe it has to then trade off some resources, let's say, for example, some hypothetical gold mines to Chinese companies in return for the loan that was provided. So this kind of and you could look at it as either a vicious circle or a virtuous circle, depending on how you look at it, but this sort of a circle that reinforces these countries' dependency on China when it comes to loans.
So Thailand, you know, being the ex advisor to ex Prime Minister of Kyrgyzstan, who is now in jail in connection to some of the controversies involving the Chinese loan to Kyrgyzstan, what is your take on some of the concerns that Sam has been raising about the smaller nations, which is obviously Kyrgyzstan part of that?
Yes, indeed, what Sam has said is accurate about levels of debt in our countries, as well as the share of China's debt. Here, also, I would like to add one factor. It's the official debt to GDP ratio takes into account the official GDP. However, the different estimates say that the real GDP, at least for the country, for Kyrgyzstan, could be higher. It's up to 40% of the economy is in the gray zone and accounted for. So if, for example, the real economy is calculated, maybe the debt levels won't be, in terms of like percentage, won't be as high as it seems. But still, the level is worrisome because the major portion of repayment is coming up in 2-3 years. So our countries will have to prepare a larger share of government budgets to repay the debts. However, at the current time, the budgets are unbalanced. So the revenues of these countries are less than the expenses. And the difference is covered usually by the support of international partners. This is indeed a concern that public officials in our countries keep in mind, but they have not come up with a solution how to repay this growing level of debt repayment that's coming up soon.
Okay, Nadish, let's bring you on here. So first, your reaction to Sam and Thailand's point of view. Second, where do the other Central Asian nations stand as to their dependency on Chinese money?
I think both our colleagues touched upon very important points here, talking about the debt levels and the problem that causes for those countries. I think we need to think in terms of repayment. And so, as Sam mentioned, the repayment, if these economies are too weak to repay the loans that China gave them with some currency, then China might be willing to get some assets or some resources. So the Sri Lankan example is very interesting because Sri Lanka couldn't repay their debt, and so they allowed China to take this 99-year lease on the very important port. Obviously, in Central Asia, it couldn't be a port, but it could be energy resources or any other form of resources that those countries have, including mines or things like that. So that could turn into increased dependency, a loss of sovereignty over natural assets. It could also turn into some sort of political leverage that China could have in these countries, and demands that China could have on at the political level to support China's interests more broadly, not just in the region, but more broadly. And also, it raises the question of the repayment and therefore whether those countries will turn to international financial institutions to help them cope with their level of debt. And finally, I want to say that, you know, we're looking at those debt levels, but the deals and the contracts that China is making through Belt and Road Initiative are mostly opaque and government-to-government level. And so this is completely out of the public sphere for most of them. And there's a high level of corruption of the local elites that go with the Belt and Road deals as well. So it's another form of leverage that China is taking over the political elites of these regions, not just in terms of national debt level, but also in terms of corruption of the local elites. So that might work for countries other than Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan that you mentioned earlier as well.
Bruce, let me get your thought on something that Nadezhda just mentioned, the Chinese interest in specific projects, which also has to do with energy when it comes to Central Asia. And this brings me to Turkmenistan. As you know, China is the only customer of Turkmen gas, and Turkmenistan is cash strapped. And problem is growing, I believe, lately in the arrangement involving the Chinese loan and the gas contract all remain a secret between Turkmenistan and China. So I have no proof to say this, but when I think of the ongoing crisis, financial crisis in Turkmenistan, it kind of reminds me of trap that Sri Lanka has fallen into. So my question is, could there be any link between Turkmenistan's ongoing financial crisis and its dealings with China?
It's certainly part of it, one would have to say. I mean, as you noted, China is currently the only customer for Turkmen gas, which wouldn't be such a horrible thing if the situation was different. But we know that China has extended billions of dollars worth of loans to Turkmenistan, both to develop the gas fields in Turkmenistan, to build the pipelines that lead to China, and for a number of other infrastructure projects that are going on in Turkmenistan. So if Turkmenistan was just selling its gas and getting all the profit back from its gas sales, it still wouldn't be enough to prop up the economy in the shape it's in. But it makes it worse that Turkmenistan is simultaneously paying off a loan while it is exporting gas to China. So they are not receiving the full amount for their gas. We don't know what the percentage of payments are going toward loans, the repayment of loans, and what percentage actually comes into state coffers in Turkmenistan. But it obviously couldn't be very much, looking at the situation in Turkmenistan. So, this is a trap. Now, that said, it's worth mentioning that Turkmenistan is kind of a unique case because it has been so isolationist for so long that it really had very few partners to start with. And with the aggravation of ties with Russia and more recently with Iran, it's kind of trapped itself into a corner here. And really the only lifeline it has for money at the moment is China. And it's already, again, we don't know the exact figure, but it's clear that Turkmenistan owes China a lot of money and is likely to continue to owe China a great deal of money for years to come.
I also wonder, Nadezh, your point of view on this. Turkmenistan is ongoing financial crisis and it is dealings with China. Is there anything we are missing?
It's very difficult, I think, from the outside to ponder which factor is the most important. I think the China factor in any country in the region is getting more and more important. And although China has this principle of non-interference in internal affairs, I think in some cases, the China factor is more and more prominent. And it's not necessarily because Beijing interferes directly into the political system in the region, but because of those growing dependencies, both financial, economic, political, strategic, security-wise, there's a growing Chinese presence. But it's really hard to quantify and to evaluate because, again, most of what's happening is really not in the open, so it's difficult.
Sam, you also mentioned this earlier. The region, the Central Asia, is already in debt to China. Smaller countries are running the risk of falling into some sort of trap, especially Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan. So, and China is now coming with billions of additional funds to the region as part of its Belt and Road project. So what does this project really brings to the region?
So when a country, especially a cash-strapped country, a very cash-strapped, impoverished country like Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan, when suddenly there's a big lender on the horizon who lends, let's say, a few billion dollars, which is like a substantial portion of the economy, it's very tempting to take all of those loans and put them into projects that may not necessarily have as big dividends or projects that may not be profitable. So, I mean, debt is not necessarily bad. I mean, a lot of times debt can help to plug in financing gaps, and it's especially important for smaller countries like Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan. In a way, debt can help a country in its growth path. But at the same time, what is important is that the money from these loans are put into constructive projects that deliver a profit in the future, that deliver a sustainable return. And that return can then help to pay off these debts in the future. I mean, that is the internal aspect of the country. There's also an external aspect where a country's repayment also depends on the overall macroeconomic environment. For example, if there's a downturn, obviously that affects the country's ability to pay. But I think the bottom line is that a lot of debt is not necessarily bad. But what is more important is the type of projects that these money is put into.
Again, kind of Sri Lanka's example reminds me of one thing, that part of this Chinese loan, they also built an airport, which is now closed, I believe.
It's not exactly. I think this airport was supposed to service a lot of customers who would never end up using this airport in the first place. I mean, it's a tiny country, so there's no need for this huge airport that services like a lot of people. So, I mean, that goes into the point that I was trying to make about when a small country is suddenly flush with a lot of cash, there is this temptation to just throw in money everywhere and just invest it in projects that are not really necessary. So I think the important point is how smaller countries like Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan use the money that they're obtaining from China.
Mm-hmm. So Talent, this is your topic basically. So tell us how Kyrgyzstan is using the Chinese loan that the country gets.
Well, most of the loans that we received from China were used for energy projects. And actually, over the past several years, Kyrgyzstan has become more sustainable in its energy situation. Hmm. Also, road infrastructure was another share, big share of the loans. And then there is this big project that's under consideration, a railway from China through Kyrgyzstan to Uzbekistan. However, the discussions have been going on for many years and not sure for when and if this project would become possible. And I think that China is now learning to invest maybe more responsibly, because in the past, unlike other financial institutions, it was much easier to receive loans from China because of no conditionalities. And two, the economic viability of projects also wasn't very much evaluated. But as the, I guess, time comes for repayment, I think Chinese authorities are coming to realization that maybe they should look at projects more carefully. And I think there are signs now, especially with the Belt and Road initiatives, that new projects would go under more scrutiny. I think learning from the World Bank and trying to use the World Bank and other international organizations' practices in terms of evaluation of projects. And I also here wanted to mention a very scandalous situation with the heating plant project that was reconstructed with the help of Chinese funding. Mm-hmm. We had last winter, we had a failure in the heating plant, but which happened in the old portion of it, not in the part which was reconstructed by the Chinese loan. But this was used as a pretext to criticize the then the Prime Minister Isakov. Accusation goes that as a head of a department in the president's office, a 35-year-old Isakov convinced the Prime Minister, the ministers, to negotiate with the Chinese to sign the agreement. And he convinced 120 members of the parliament to ratify this agreement. And now all the blame goes to him, that he was lobbying a particular Chinese company, although it was actually authorized by Chinese authorities. They said only this company would be constructing the heating plant. But this became a very, I think, face-losing exercise for China, because the project was discussed for 3 days in a row in the parliament. And of course, MPs were very careful to blame the Kyrgyz side, not blame the Chinese side. But since the money actually never entered Kyrgyzstan, it was just transferred from the Exim Bank to a Chinese company, for the MPs, it was a very difficult situation how to deal with it. So we will see, of course, how it will all unfold in the future.
Hmm. I have two questions here, Nadezh, maybe. One is, like Talant was saying, that China is more sensitive in its loan policy recently. Is your research supports this? And the second is the element of corruption wherever the China does any project. Like in Malaysia's case that earlier Sam has referred to, Prime Minister Mahathir was saying, I think on Tuesday, when he announced the cancellation of two projects worth like close to $30 billion, he was saying two things, basically. One is that the country cannot afford these projects. The second is he was saying that these projects can be built for half of the prices that it was agreed with the previous administration in Malaysia. So the element of corruption, coming back to Kyrgyzstan as this heating plant as an example, like, yes, Talent has explained some insight into what happened there. But the opponents of the Prime Minister Isakov also would say that there was a corruption involved in this, in the same way that the Malaysian Prime Minister has referred to.
Well, going back to how China invests now in the Belt and Road projects, it's true that when Beijing launched the initiative, you had a lot of different projects under the Belt and Road label that were scattered all around the world, and that really, some of them didn't really have anything to do with infrastructure projects. Mm. And so after a year or two, the central government in Beijing decided to rein in those investments and to provide some guidelines for Chinese investments and the direction of these loans to make it more efficient in some way, you know, no more real estate or no more soccer club investment, but real infrastructure. And so it's true that there's a re-evaluation of where China wants to invest. And Sam is also right when he says that now China is trying to bring in other international financial institutions to help with financing those projects, so that China is not the only one that gets the burden of the investments that are made. So big portion of the infrastructure projects that are taken under the Belt and Road are now jointly financed by AIIB, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, that was launched by Beijing, in coordination with other financial institutions such as the World Bank, the European Bank, etc. So in order to make sure that those projects are more sustainable in the future, some of them are still a priority of China policy bank, such as the Exim Bank or the China Development Bank. And these are probably more strategic in the Chinese terms. I also wanted to point out something, you know, looking at the domestic view of those investments, and I think Talent just said it, you know, these for the local governments, these investments are very important. Sometimes they actually answering a need, a local need. Sometimes the local governments think that it's a great way to maybe help with the trade and with the growth, the economic growth. It's also a question of prestige. And I would say it's also for them maybe a way to leverage this Chinese interest in their country to attract other investors. I've seen that, for example, in the South Pacific, where little island countries have been literally washed up with Chinese investments. And suddenly Australia realizes that they also need to bring some money in and tighten their cooperation with those little islands. Otherwise, China is going to be the only partner of the region, and Australia cannot do that. So I'm wondering whether in Central Asia it might not also be the same, you know, that talk to Moscow and maybe get some interesting cooperation or maybe talk to Europe and find some ways to attract those other investors, to attract the interest of these other countries, so that you can get a better deal out of it.
So
you enlarge your partnerships with others.
Yeah, let's take the local perspective on this. Bruce, do you like to jump in?
You know, I mean, there's a couple things working here that actually work against Central Asia. One, the level of investment prior to Chinese arrival in Central Asia, and I would really, you know, mark that as certainly no longer than 20 years ago, but in most cases, we're only talking about a decade or a little bit more. You know, there wasn't a whole lot of Western investment, certainly, in Central Asia, you know, and hasn't been really since independence at all. Russia was seen as the big investor. And of course, they've had their economic ups and downs, to put it mildly. And when there was times when Russia had a lot of money, they were the big investors in Central Asia. About 10 years ago, that really slowed down a lot. All of a sudden, it became clear that Russia did not have a huge amount of money to invest, and certainly post-2014, practically nothing. So the Chinese kind of came in 1998, they signed the deal with Kazakhstan to build the oil pipeline. That was really the first big step that they got out there. But their presence in Central Asia grew phenomenally at the same time that Russia's economic clout in the region declined because of problems that Russia had. So the Chinese filled a vacuum that was being created by the lack of Russian ability to invest in the region. What's alarming about that was it increased phenomenally. In a very short time, it went from, you know, and there's been articles that show that, you know, for instance, Tajikistan's debt went from like 2% of the GDP to 44% of the GDP in just, you know, less than 10 years. And this is the kind of thing that happened with them. China is a necessary partner for them because they need outside investment. The region has traditionally not attracted that much investment, except for from Russia. So they need an investor. And here's one that's a neighbor right next door, making easy loans, you know, so it's almost impossible for them to decline this kind of money. But at the same time, they aren't used to having somebody being able to pour so much money into their countries. Now, for China, this is not a huge amount of money, but for the Central Asians, certainly Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, this is a big amount of money. Now, another thing that we got to consider is that the Central Asians are used to the fact that when they've run up big debts with Russia, if they hold out long enough, sooner or later, the Kremlin will forgive at least part of the debt and possibly write off the whole debt for a while, for minor concessions, you know, or just to keep a hold on the region. And I think they're banking on the fact too much that if they get into serious trouble with China, that somehow or another, one way, you know, further down the road, they'll be able to negotiate, you know, a partial or full write-off of the debt that they got. You know, we've seen China write off a huge amount of debt to Venezuela in the recent years. But I'm not sure that would be China's policy towards Central Asia. You know, we've already mentioned the asset transfers in Tajikistan's case, gold mine. But there's been concerns that China's ultimate goal in this is to run the Central Asians into sufficient debt that they get access to mining rights for rare earths in the mountains of Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, for example. So we don't know all of China's motives, but Central Asia's history of incurring debt has shown that it's their creditors have been much more lenient in the past, and we don't know what China's policy will be when it comes time to pay off these debts, if they're willing to forgive these some of this money, or if they're willing to, you know, really play hardball and say, you owe us the money, and if you don't have it, you're going to have to hand over something as compensation.
So what also this really mean to Central Asia in long term, and what is next going forward for Central Asia and Chinese rule in Central Asia? We will continue the discussion talking about these and many other questions very shortly. But first, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia podcast, we are discussing Central Asia's financial dealings with China and what does this say about China's future rule in the region. Joining me in the discussion are Talant Sultanov, the former advisor to Kyrgyzstan's ex-Prime Minister Sapar Isakov. Sam Bhutia is joining us. He's the Economist Intelligence Unit's Central Asia specialist. Nadej Roland is with us, who's the author of China's Eurasian Century, Political and Strategic Implications of the Belt and Road Initiative, and Bruce Pioneer, the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia, Blog Kishlok Owazi. I am Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, colleagues. Now, to come back to your question, Bruce, it might sound a little bit alarmist, but do you think Central Asia is destined to share Sri Lanka or Djibouti's fate going forward?
Well, you know, I mentioned that Tajikistan had already handed over a gold mine as compensation for some Chinese loans. I don't see, you know, how else they're going to be able to pay off these loans without somewhere along the line handing over something China wants. I mean, China doesn't want to operate a power plant or a hydropower plant or something like that, because that doesn't pay off fast enough. They would be looking for something much more suited to their purposes. They tend to view Central Asia as a resource base for themselves. And so they would be looking for some, like I said, mining concessions or something like that they could actually get a hold of and get things moving over to that they want over to China as fast as possible. That's bad for Central Asia, of course, in the long run, because that's like money in the bank for them. You know, the gold mines, the rare earths, things like that. I mean, that's stuff that future generations can use, you know, to keep their economies running. And to transfer these kind of things over to China is a short-term solution to the debt problem. But it just kind of kicks the can down the road, to use an expression that was popular in the U.S. a while ago, where you can pay it off now, but sooner or later, your country is still going to be in an economic hardship or hard place, and you won't have the resources that you can rely on to pay back debts that you're going to incur in the future.
Talan, so when you guys go to China to take these huge loans, how you imagine to repay this, and why you go to China, first of all?
I agree with the previous speakers. I think our countries use this light-hearted approach for borrowing, especially because with the loans also come the grant component. And I think we need to consider two factors here. Maybe motives of China providing such easy money for our countries is to keep us happy and restive, because there is a region in the northwest of China that's a big headache, I think, for the central government of the country, Xinjiang. And when there are neighbors such that share border with this region who continue to support this policy of three evils, the separatism, terrorism, and extremism, and all of our countries signed in the framework of the Shanghai Cooperation Agreement to fight these three evils. So I think for China, it's better to keep our countries stable. If suddenly, at the time of debt repayment, if China plays a hardball and start demanding land concessions on or resource concessions, it's very unpredictable how the situation would unfold in this area. There were, for example, when I spoke about a potential railroad project, one of the proposed schemes was resources in exchange for the railroad. A few years ago in Kyrgyzstan, but the public outcry was so big that this proposal didn't fly. So I think there are more considerations to these relations than simple economy. It's the security and I think political issues that we have to keep in mind. I'm sure that difficult negotiations are ahead, but I also think that the resilience of our economies is bigger than we think. If there is a good governance now, we should be able to accumulate enough reserves to service our debts in the future.
Wow. Talan said many things, Nadesh, one of which was particularly interesting, where he said when the time for debt settlement come, China might not wish to play a hardball with Central Asia because it wouldn't take the risk of instabilizing its neighbor when China is faced with disturbance of its own in Xinjiang province. This is certainly a consideration. Your thoughts on this argument, please.
I think that Talan made very, very good points, and I wanted to press on that too, because I think it's very important. From China's perspective, the economic relationship is not really the same as how we, from the outside, can see it. There's a strong connection here between economy and security. And so we need to also understand that from Beijing's perspective, first of all, the Belt and Road Initiative was primarily launched to serve the Chinese Communist Party's own interests. It's a way for China to expand its outward influence, but it's also a way for the country to sustain its own economic development and ultimately to make sure that the CCP continues to rule the country. So that is a very important connection that Talan just made with Xinjiang in particular. As he mentioned, Central Asia is key, not just for the energy security of the Chinese economy, but also for the plain terrorism security of what China thinks is important for its own physical security against terrorist elements. And so, you know, the investments that China is making inside of Central Asian countries, we might think that China would want to get repaid from it, but think of it in terms of security, and then maybe China will be able to get some political and security benefits out of it, including, you know, the control over maybe Uyghur populations that are within Central Asian countries, prevent them from going back to China if they have been radicalized somehow. I think this is really prominent in the way Beijing thinks about Central Asian countries as well. And so you can also see this into, you know, you need to put, again, Belt and Road. Belt and Road is not just about infrastructure. It's about building a set of corporations that allow China to have a bigger influence on a variety of domains, and that includes security as well. And so when you see the transformation, the acceleration of China's economic grasp over the region, you need also to think that more recently there's an acceleration of those security cooperation under the SCO, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization framework, but also at the bilateral level, and mostly having to do with what they call stability maintenance. which includes obviously surveillance of the local population and so on and so forth.
Mm.
So, you know, you need to see this within the broader framework of China's own political and strategic interests within its own backyard.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. When you look into this Chinese initiative, obviously, economy, security, and cooperation all could be part of that. But India has a specific view about Chinese intention, Sam, isn't it?
Well, speaking just as a lay Indian person, I think India's always been suspicious of any Chinese overarching projects, especially in the neighborhood. And India has always had a very fractious relationship with China. Even though in China, people apparently aren't as aware of the fractious relationship that India has with China. And I think India was initially opposed to the BRI as well, because a part of the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which is considered to be one of the flagship projects of the BRI, is passing through contested territory between India and Pakistan. So India has been suspicious, and India maybe at a certain level also feels like it's being surrounded on different sides by Chinese presence, like Chinese presence in Sri Lanka, a Chinese presence in Pakistan, maybe a potential Chinese presence in Himalayan countries of Nepal or Bhutan. So there is a certain sense of paranoia, but at the same time, I think India has always been wary of Chinese projects.
Yeah. Bruce, let's look into this from a different angle. So when you look into Central Asia, you will see all sort of these problems, corruption, mismanagement, both lack of will or skills among the authorities to put their countries on the path which leads to prosperity. Do you think there is enough awareness among Chinese authorities about where they are getting into? In other words, are they aware of the consequences of pouring additional billions of dollars to this region and how they will get out of it when things turn out opposite to their expectations?
Oh, surely they're aware of it now. You know, again, China didn't have much of a footprint in Central Asia until about 20 years ago. And even then, it's only really the last 10 years. So I think, you know, they're also gradually learning more and more about how Central Asia works and what can happen to Chinese investment in the region, Chinese presence, participation in the region. Of course, we know that they send workers for many of their projects, and they're part of, they're living in a lot of these areas now. So this is something, again, that the Central Asians aren't really used to, but the Chinese certainly are becoming more and more aware. You know, again, I would mention that for China, this is kind of a no-lose situation, because although the amounts of money seem like they're huge to a country like Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan, let's face it, $2 billion or something is not very much for Beijing. That's not much. You know, they could actually lose that and write off the debt, and it really wouldn't make that big of a difference. But they do appreciate having some influence in the region. And so I suppose looking at it from that point of view, it's kind of good if the neighbors are in debt, because at least it does give them some leverage in the region. And again, it doesn't cost China a lot of money. You know, I agree with the point that they want to make sure that Central Asia is stable and that it keeps itself together. There's no doubt about that. You know, Nadezh would know a little bit better than me, but I think there's like 14 countries that border China. And if you look at some of the neighbors that they have, they're not on good terms. You mentioned India, but Vietnam is another one, you know, and there's a few like that they're not really sure of. One of the most stable relationships that they have with their neighbors is the relationships they have with the Central Asian countries. So this is a big bonus for China, you know, and there's a lot for them to consider when they approach their policies towards Central Asia, because they really do profit from having a good relationship with the Central Asian countries. You know, at the same time, it's undeniable that their influence in the region is growing. You know, again, when I was working there in the early 90s, it was nobody from China there, none. And it was only really about, you know, 2005, 2006, when I would go out there, that I started to notice that there were more Chinese that had made their way into Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan and parts of Kazakhstan. And now, of course, if you go, they're unmistakably there. There's almost nowhere you can go in Central Asia without running into Chinese workers or Chinese projects or something. You know, Talant would know, if you drive from north to south in Kyrgyzstan, you are bound to come across a road crew that will be half Chinese that's out there. So, you know, it also provides, I suppose, jobs for some of their own citizens, too.
Yeah, it's been a really fascinating discussion, but we have to conclude the debate. Concluding this, let me put this question to you, Nadezh. So going forward, so what are the, let's say, two positive and negative things do you see coming out of increasing Chinese rule in Central Asia?
That's an interesting question. Positive things. Well, This is a hard one, but let me say, maybe, you know, as Talent mentioned, those countries need the investment. So yeah. It is a positive thing that China is willing to overcome the risks and invest in those countries. However, on the negative side, again, I think it creates dependencies that are not necessarily working to the benefit of those countries. And second, I think it's going to weaken and slow down the possibility of liberalization and democratization of these countries. Because again, as China makes inroads in the region, it also brings its own neo-authoritarian system with it. And that is also very attractive for those countries who want to keep their own rules stable. So for the long run, the forces of liberalization might be a little bit more difficult to promote with a growing Chinese influence in the region.
Okay, the same question to the rest of the panel. So Sam, maybe to continue with you, the same question.
I think we should be wary of kind of bringing this very alarmist picture mm-hmm. and saying that, oh, all Chinese loans and debt is necessarily going to be bad. I think Chinese loans to Central Asia, especially for smaller countries like Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, do provide a lot of opportunities for these countries. I think it's important for them to reach a stage, to improve their business environment, to reach a stage where they can appeal to investors from other countries as well, and they can reduce their reliance on China. I think China is a world hegemon. We have to get used to the idea of China being a very important player in Central Asia, just because it's a very important player in the world at the moment. So I think there are opportunities for Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan. It's incumbent on them how they choose to use this particular opportunity.
Okay, so Talent, the same questions. So two positive and negative takeaways from increasing Chinese rule in your region. What are they?
Well, I think, first of all, now if you drive around Kyrgyzstan, we have very nice roads, which are constructed thanks to the Chinese loans. The minus of it, most of the roads are constructed by Chinese workers and Chinese equipment. So the economic impact in terms of job creation for local population wasn't very big directly from this project. Second, I think positive is that since we are the countries between Europe, China, where China wants to get its products, we can benefit from the transit of goods. And maybe second negative is indeed the years ahead are going to be very difficult in terms of debt repayment. So we have to get ready now to be able to repay those in the 2-3 years that are coming up.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Bruce, you have the option of wrapping up the discussion. So the same question to you.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to kind of echo some of that stuff. Some of the positive things are definitely that projects that really do need to be built and no one else could possibly finance right now are getting built. Kamen-Datka power line from Kyrgyzstan is very important. It's up and running now. It was built with Chinese help. That's an example of a project that really worked. Thermal power plant in Dushanbe is another one that it's helped to alleviate some of the power outages that they had in the winter. So those are very good. Being close to China economically is especially important for Central Asia right now, because if you look at what their ties to Russia are, and I'm talking about migrant laborers and things, that when Russia's economy is hurting, it affects Central Asia a lot. Now, they've been cushioned a little bit because they do have good economic ties with China. You've seen the remittances have dropped and sometimes the workplaces are diminishing. But there is another option for Central Asia, which has really helped them. I mean, if China was sealed off to them, it would be difficult to imagine the situation Central Asia would be in if they were so dependent on Russia right now. So these are two good things about it. Now, the negative thing, again, is I don't know how long they can keep incurring debt like this. Even a benign China that doesn't demand payments will still use this in the future as some kind of pressure on the Central Asians when they're not cooperating to the extent that China wants. It will remind them that you owe us a lot of money. And we have built up a lot of your infrastructure. And in fact, China is the only one that can maintain some of these infrastructure projects that's being built, unless the Central Asians are willing to pay outside help a lot of money to fix power lines and redo roads that avalanches and things like that. I mean, they're going to almost be dependent upon China to do that. And it keeps China in the region for a long time, for good or bad. But like I said, my biggest concern is just that it gives China, it's almost like a form of economic colonialism in a way. It hasn't gone that far, but I mean, it gets to the point where China has a lot of say because they are the banker of the region. And, you know, we've seen what happens with Turkmenistan, that when if China doesn't like a deal, then they go, we don't know exactly the details of it, but they're able to press Turkmenistan, you know, to make new concessions, lower prices, allow China to have more, expand fields that they're already working on the right bank of the Amu Darya, things like that. So that's my big concern. I think that's the negative.
Yeah. The economic colonialism, Bruce, you mentioned. This is exactly what the Malaysian prime minister has said when canceling the two mega projects involving China. Well, fascinating discussion. Thank you very much, Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia, Blok, Kishlok, Owozi. And also big thanks goes to Talant Sultanov, the former advisor to Kyrgyzstan's ex-prime minister, Isakov, and Sam Botia, the Economist Intelligence Unit's Central Asia specialist, Nadej Roland, author of China's Eurasian Century, Political and Strategic Implications of the Belt and Road Initiative. Thank you very much, colleagues, for your time and thoughts today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. And this is from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia podcast. Until next week, bye-bye.